It's Six-ish on Sunday night. Welcome to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Luna's KX935. My topic tonight is how not to raise a brat, or how to not raise a brat. And it's a bit presumptuous because I actually never had children, so I was never faced with that particular dilemma. But don't laugh, I've raised dogs. So basically, I have raised a being of whom I have certain requirements in order for them to share my life, my world, my house. They have certain requirements of me. They require love, food, and a comfortable place to sleep. Also, a conflict-free environment, if possible, somewhere they feel safe. In return, I require basically just two things of them. Compliance. It's a gentler word than obedience, and trustworthiness. And those really are the two things that you require of a child in order for them not to be a brat. A dog is a more simple being than a child, certainly after a certain point in a child's development, but basically the requirements are similar. Where the complexity comes in is certain breeds are more inclined towards compliance and trustworthiness than others, perhaps. Nevertheless, those things can be taught. With children, it gets a bit more complex. They also have ingrained characteristics, depending on their breed, as it were. And if you're to believe the stars, depending on the time of year they were born. If they were born in the middle of the year, if they're Cancers, they're likely to be more eager to please, more gentle and loving, but also obstinate. If they're born towards the end of the year, have a Scorpio personality, they're likely to be very charismatic, able to wrap you around their fingers, but also turn around and sting you out of the blue, be less malleable. So some breeds will require more time, patience, and training than others. Still, teaching compliance, teaching trustworthiness is important. They need to be able to come when they're called. They need to be able to stay and not move when you tell them to when they're in danger. You need to be able to leave them alone in the house when there's a cake on the table. Those are all metaphors, obviously, when it comes to children, but not when it comes to dogs. So the question is, how do you inculcate those things in children, especially those breeds that aren't inclined to respond to authority, have genetic factors, a proclivity for obsessive behaviours? How about environmental factors, gangs and the like? And don't forget, I'm English, so we have much stricter ideas about child upbringings than you have in America. And as I said, I'm talking a little off my head, but I have some more professional opinions and advice coming up on this Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. First, just a quick aside. A friend of mine said that she has raised her children to be people she wants around her rather than possessions. And as a result, she and her husband agree that they have fun people to travel the world with. But we're going to get some other perspectives on that. I'm going to quote to you now from an article about how not to raise a brat from Town and Country, a magazine that can tend to cater to the privileged. And the privileged, as we know, can be more bratty than others. This Town Country article is by Ron Lieber, and he starts by talking about a conversation that Jon Stewart and Chris Rock had on Jon Stewart's show, where Stewart was teasing Chris Rock about wanting to avoid his family. And Chris Rock said, "My kids are rich. I have nothing in common with them. I don't like these people. I don't understand them." Apparently, Stewart stammered somewhat, but then admitted that he also felt a similar discomfort with his offspring. He said he'd started working when he was 14 years old. He suggested that maybe there should be some kind of spiritual delousing for their children, a kind of outward bound course for kids like theirs. And Rock replied that every summer he tried to put his kids in camp in Harlem, but his wife wouldn't let him. He said, "We should put all the neighborhood kids there so they could get beaten up and have their lunch money stolen." He said there's got to be somewhere a camp kick butt. So what to do for these kind of well-motivated parents who don't want their kids to be spoiled and need somebody to knock the entitlement out of them. Maybe not literally, but at least to let them have a taste of deprivation. I have noticed, and this is me aside now, Sharon James of KX935 Sharon Hour, that a lot of nouveau riche parents who did themselves grow up deprived and now have money don't want their children to know about deprivation. You know, we live in Orange County. We all know those parents that buy their children everything and don't even want them to think about not being able to have everything because they grew up with a lot of anxiety about not having enough to get by, and they don't want that same thing for their children. So they kind of wipe that possibility out of their children's lives. They don't even discuss it. They don't even subject them to other children that don't have what their children have. And they don't deny them anything because they imagine that's going to ease their anxiety and make life wonderful for their kids in ways that it wasn't for them. But it doesn't seem to be the answer. Understanding money and the value of it and what it buys, and correlating the cost of the things that you have to money that you earn or that has been saved or invested for you, is crucial at a certain point in a child's life. That's why many child psychologists suggest older children being put to work to earn money. If you've been given money all your life, you can't really expect a child to develop an understanding of it. I was just reading about Tori Spelling possibly having to go to jail because she'd amassed so much debt without having any way to pay it off. And incidentally, still tossing away $40,000 on a birthday shower for her tot. Her father, Aaron Spelling, was notoriously wealthy. I think their house in Beverly Hills took up an entire city block. So it's not always an advantage growing up with anything and everything at your disposal, especially if you find it suddenly taken away. I believe he disinherited Tori. I remember hearing about a kid who'd grown up wealthy who wrote a check that bounced. He couldn't understand why it bounced. He said, "It was my checkbook. I have more checks in my checkbook, even." He didn't understand that it wasn't really anything to do with the checkbook per se, it was to do with the money in the bank behind the checkbook. But you know, money is just a piece of paper, really. A $20 bill even is just a piece of paper. You only really understand that it's a piece of paper that you get when you do something for it. Earn it, put it in the bank or under the mattress, take it out. So for some very wealthy parents who have earned a lot, whether meritoriously or not, isn't the particular issue, what to do to inculcate some sort of value of goods and experiences to money in their offspring. A variety of wealthy men and women have decided that simply giving their children a lot of money is probably not the best way to set them up in life. As I just indicated, your financial status can change, and if those children suddenly find themselves with a lack of available funds and have no idea how to make their own money or budget for themselves or even the ethics involved in accruing money, yet don't know how to live without it or an abundance of it, that's when the lessons learned from general good parenting or the lack thereof will come into play.
To be free, I bet he
root of all evil. I'm currently talking about the part it plays in my topic on the Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. That topic is how not to raise a brat. And obviously, the spectre of money comes into play in that context. Bernie Eccleston, the former Formula One boss, has talked about his regret at having given his young adult daughters unfettered access to their enormous trust with mid-eight-figure homes, amongst other goodies, when they were barely out of their teens. Bill Gates has made it public that he and his wife Melinda are going to give the vast majority of their fortune to their foundation and that their kids are fine with that. It's a plan modelled on Warren Buffett's. Warren Buffett has also publicly stated that his children aren't going to inherit his enormous wealth. He believes that his children should inherit enough to give them financial freedom so that they can do almost anything they want for a living, but not so much financial freedom that they don't have to do anything for a living. So that's not to say that they're not going to benefit at all. In fact, the Gates children are reputed to inherit around $10 million each. On the other hand, that's not until their parents die. So, meantime, they do need to earn their own living. Sting has also pledged to spend or give away most of his money. He says he's not given a lot to his six children from two marriages. On the other hand, they've probably attended the best schools because his name, like Gates or Buffett, has opened every door on earth. So there's privilege attached merely to the name. Here's what Julie Lithcott-Hames, the former dean of freshmen at Stanford University, has suggested. And this is based on an essay she read in the Chronicle of Higher Education by a Stanford colleague called Terry Castle, who is an English professor. In his essay, Castle presented being an orphan not just as an actual state, but as a metaphorical one also. The metaphorical orphans are sad, but they may also be wise and lucky and tricky and worldly and ultimately exemplary. In this metaphorical orphaned state, parents are flawed, absent, or oblivious. So one would be better off without them, in other words, better off as an orphan. Julia Lithcott-Hames suggests that the orphan trope is a wonderful reminder that people lead breathtaking lives, encounter tremendous obstacles, fall, get back up, persist, and ultimately succeed and lead wild lives of adventure in the absence of parents. She says the reason that orphans in fiction become our heroes is because they do it all themselves. As for herself, she actually sacrificed a lot to give her children a privileged life, moving to Palo Alto because of the excellent public schools there. Not that the children necessarily acknowledged or appreciated it, because it was really all they knew. That fact wasn't shoved down their throat. And a lot of parents do that. Leave the communities that are familiar to them and their friends to become part of a better community that they want for their children. But do those parents pick the right communities ultimately to set their children on their way in life is the question. That question spawned a business called Suburban Jungle, which is actually a suburb selection consultancy to serve affluent families in and around the Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco areas to help them figure out which communities are actually going to be best for them and their children. And these are the kinds of questions that Suburban Jungle asks. Do you want a place where people make tons of money but drive old cars and live in smaller houses because they'd rather spend the money traveling the world and enriching the cultural life of their children? That's one question. Or do you want a place where the people can't afford college because they're leveraged to the hilt in order to live there at all? There are other questions for parents to consider. Is it a country club going community or a town pool sort of place? Is there anything of a summer community to it? Or is everyone heading off to Nantucket or sleepaway camp? Those are questions you need to ask before you've moved there. If you have kids that don't want to go away and or on whom you've also spent your last cent to buy the house in that community to be able to send them to a good school, you don't have anything left to send your kids away. Those are questions to ask yourself before you've moved. And then maybe you want a more laid-back town, so it's not the general pressure for upward mobility. It's a generally more relaxed vibe the town has. Most people don't consider these kinds of things. Instead, they just automatically aim for the town with the best schools and the most people who like them or that they want to be like. And the kids basically become spoiled because of their parents' choices for their own lives. One New York City parent was very proud that she'd gotten rid of her housekeeper because she wanted her boys to learn to do housework and also to see her doing it. And she said when they fly with her, they travel in coach. But when Dad's along, she says they take their private jet. She wondered whether she might be confusing them. There's the story of a young son on a ski vacation who decided he didn't want to fly back home at the appointed hour on the premise that what was the point of having access to a private plane if you couldn't make your own schedule? So in protest, he ditched his family and hid out for hours, leaving the plane idling on the tarmac at thousands of dollars per hour. His parents docked his trust fund. John Bogle, who founded Vanguard, the giant mutual fund company, and is a self-made man, said that by the time he was a parent, he felt he didn't need his kids to earn money, but that they did need the experience of working for someone else, because you have to learn things like sometimes a boss can be mean, and that sometimes a customer is wrong, and you have to pretend he's right, that kind of thing. There's the thinking that, at the very least, parents should let their children work off their mistakes, you know, whether they've banged up the car or destroyed some private property. Sally Krawcheck, who's the co-founder and CEO of Elevest, an online investment platform for women, tells the story of having given her teenage son a credit card to use for the things he needed, except that he got a little loose with the definition of need, particularly when it came to one online store. So to pay back what he spent, he was sent to work at a not online store, a real store in the town where his family spends some of their summers. So here are all his friends having a great summer at the club. And she said, we go into this store to get a Coke. And there's this kid with a blood-stained shirt from slicing the meat they sell there, stacking big crates of Coke and Pepsi and pouring off sweat. He was the only kid there, the youngest worker in the store by far. And she said she felt terrible and really sorry that he'd gotten into this mess. But she was determined he was going to get himself out of it. Her tip is, use a prepaid debit card and put a set amount on it if you're going to give an emergency card to your kids. But she did say that it's actually hard to bring down the hammer on kids that can Google you and discover exactly how much you earn, and then hold that up against you while they're struggling with their part-time jobs. So you have to think about the answer you're going to give your kids when they say, how come you got so much and I got so little? When they're younger, you can just tell them that they don't have the context to understand the answer you're going to give them. But when they're older, that probably won't do it. You just have to find a way to explain that your wealth isn't automatically theirs and that they're not necessarily going to inherit yours. Sally Krawcheck's son is now 23, out of college, teaching English in Taiwan. He's been told that he may have a bit of money coming to them as part of the family estate, but that the amount will decline over time because a lot of the money is going to the university where Krawcheck was a Moorhead Scholar. And she has told her son that when he returns from Taiwan, there won't be a housing allowance, and he's not moving back in. She said, we don't even have a bedroom for him. Then there's the case of Chuck Feeney, who's the founder of Duty Free. He set about trying to lower his $8 billion net worth. Yes, I said $8 billion. To zero. That was his aim. At age 86, mind you. At that point, at 86, you realize you're not going to be able to take the money with you, right? the richest man in the graveyard syndrome, the have you ever seen a Brinks van following a hearse syndrome. Anyway, Chuck Feeney succeeded in his pledge to give away his entire fortune. With donations to education, public health, and human rights, he reduced his net worth from $8 billion to $2 million. If you think of a billion as 100,000 million, that's 780,000 million that he gave away. Quick reminder here that you're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. My topic tonight, how not to raise a brat, or how to not raise a brat. And obviously money and the approach to it can be a major factor when it comes to brattiness. And we've heard how some parents have chosen to deal with a certain lack of respect for it in their children. But here's another perspective. In a book called The High Price of Materialism, the author Tim Kasser suggests that if we don't teach our kids to embrace acquisitiveness, our economic and cultural systems could actually collapse, meaning that too much thriftiness would be ruinous to our system, so perhaps some overindulgent parents subconsciously convince themselves they're performing some kind of patriotic duty. We now have a social media culture among tweens and teens where at every minute they can sell enhanced versions of themselves to others, and that exacerbates the peer pressure for parents to end up spoiling their kids, certainly if they're financially well equipped to do so. This TNC article by Ron Lieber talks about what does the word spoiled actually mean, and he says the best clinical definition he's been able to come across isn't just about money. It comes from a psychologist called James Fogarty, who spent many years leading other professionals in continuing education workshops on how to deal with overindulged children. And here's his explanation of spoiled. Spoiled children have few chores or other responsibilities. Spoiled children tend not to have many rules, and if there are rules, parents tend not to enforce them. Spoiled children have every path in front of them smoothed over by their parents, who are meanwhile watching their every move. So those are three things that don't necessarily relate to money. But the fourth equation is money and providing above average amounts of material possessions and expensive experiences to your children. So here's what Dr. Fogarty recommends, which I'm going to repeat to you here on this Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. Dedicated tonight to the topic of how to avoid raising brats. In other words, how to not overindulge your children. We've mentioned number one, have them work, do a little job for extra money, help a neighbour with their yard or deliveries, do a newspaper route, plough their driveway. Well, it depends what part of the country you are growing up in. Be a rare thing for us to have to plough anyone's driveway here in Laguna Beach, Orange County. But you get the gist. Another thing he recommends, and this is equally difficult for the parent, he says one television per household, just one. So, yes, that's pretty awful, because depending on the age and gender of your child, they'll have different viewing requirements. But it is a way of keeping families together if they sit and watch TV together. Certainly it would have been insane in my day to have had more than one television. Then again, television wasn't at the centre of our lives the way it is now, or at least the way some kind of media screen is. But one television teaches cooperation, it teaches negotiation, and it teaches enforced unity, family togetherness. And since a lot of us are watching television on our computers these days, Dr. Fogarty goes a step further and says no internet in your children's bedroom. He says if you put internet in their bedroom, you're putting perpetrators in their bedroom. He tells a story of a national radio celebrity who had two police officers on his program who were also internet crime specialists. They asked the radio celebrity to randomly pick a chat line for teenagers. The radio celebrity obviously picked an average one that didn't have pornography or violence, but the police went on and presented themselves as a 14-year-old girl. And within 10 minutes, they had 50 hits from men of between 30 and 50 years old, proffering extremely sexual comments. So forget about being spoiled. There's another reason not to let children have internet tucked away in their rooms. Gifts. He says birthdays and holidays only. I imagine he's talking about proper gifts. And if he's not, I would cite an example of my mother picking me up at dancing school when I was a kid. My mother wasn't terribly motherly. She rarely, in memory, picked me up from anywhere. I walked home with friends. But this one time she picked me up and she bought me a chocolate bar, which was also unheard of. But because it was so rare, it has stuck in my mind. And I was so delighted because of the rarity of it. Even though it had marshmallow, probably the only sweet thing I didn't like. So I would qualify and say big gifts reserved for birthdays and Christmas. But every now and then, surprise them with a little gift. I do it with friends, actually. If I see something that just is perfect for them outside of birthdays and Christmas. And if you just do it once in a blue moon, how lovely is that? But that's getting off-piste. All I'm saying is it's nice to have some little tiny surprise every now and then that shows that someone's thinking of you, as well as kind of recognizing who you are, whether it's a parent in regard to a child in regard to a parent, a spouse for a spouse, a friend for a friend. Okay, so another suggestion from Dr. Fogarty is, if you think your children are lying, ask them 100 questions. He said when he got into trouble when he was a teen, his dad sat him down and asked him 100 questions about the incident. He said, I lied through my teeth and I was convincing and sure that my dad believed me. He seemed satisfied with my answers and I felt great comfort for a week. But 1 week later, he asked me the same 100 questions. And the tension rose because I couldn't remember all of my original answers. My dad looked straight at me and he said, a liar always forgets, and you are a liar. He was right. If I'd told the truth, I would have easily remembered the answers. A parent always wants to believe that their children are telling the truth, and an overindulgent parent will edit out facts so that they can continue to believe that. But if you take the time, if you ask your 100 questions, wait a week and do the same 100 questions, you'll get the truth. Not a bad tack for any relationship, though an adult would probably not allow you to subject them to 100 questions, would they? Tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, talking tonight about How Not to Raise a Brat, and bringing you some suggestions from a psychologist whose specialty is this, Dr. Jim Fogarty. He says, children are going to manipulate, so counter that, don't indulge it. They're going to make you feel guilty, but you can counter children's manipulation with indignation. They're going to try to manipulate you to get what they want. They're going to do it by trying to make you feel guilty. He says, when they try to make you guilty, don't feel guilty and don't get angry. Get indignant. Indignation is a dignified, calm anger that quietly has you state, you won't get what you want by trying to manipulate me. If you want something, I'll show you how to work for it. So instead of feeling guilty, get indignant and give them a job. He tells the story of a mother who, ever since middle school, had left her son $5 for lunch every day. This continued until he was 27 years old, had a good job, lived at home, just had a car payment that he paid, but still she left him that $5 every day until one day she forgot. He woke up, couldn't find the $5, and became enraged. Remembering that his mother had said the night before that she was going to have lunch with her friends that day, he drove to the restaurant, pulled her out, and chastised her for not having left his $5. He was so upset, he said she should give him another $5 for wasting his gas, and she gave it to him. So remember this if you're going to be indulging your children and having them expect stuff of you every day of your life. You are listening to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX93.5. I'm Sharon James, and my topic on tonight's show is how not to raise a brat. And full disclosure, I don't have kids. So you can easily ignore everything I say if you choose to. But it's not me saying it. It's a noted child psychologist called Dr. James Fogarty. Yes, his suggestions. Share hobbies with your kids. One father, knowing that his kid loved Harleys, decided to refurbish one with his son. He didn't know how, but he bought an old Harley, spread it out in pieces in the garage, and his kid was not interested. Walked past the garage with the Harley with complete indifference. So the guy came back to Dr. Fogarty and said, "Didn't work." Dr. Fogarty said, "I suggested that he get all of the chrome parts of the Harley re-chromed." He did that, displayed them carefully on the garage floor, and now when his kid walked through, he stopped and checked it out. Suddenly he was interested. The father put the computer in the garage, and together they explored the internet to find out how to do the refurbishment. At this point, they've rebuilt four classic Harleys and found a hobby in common. Another thing, he says, strip your children's bedrooms. The only items that should be in your children's bedrooms are a bed, a dresser, a mirror, clothes, and their favourite posters. The more they have in their bedrooms, the more they'll cocoon and won't want to come out, which messes with creating a gathering place in your home. We're all together, Dr. Fogarty says. When your children misbehave, they need correcting. You can still be supportive while correcting them, disciplining them. He says, parenting isn't a popularity contest. Your job is to parent, not necessarily be popular with your children. He says this, which is interesting. He says, parents who are buddies to their children rarely become buddies when their children become adults. Most mentoring parents aren't very popular through their children's teen years, but become very good friends to their adult children. I wonder if that's true. Why don't you research that in your own lives, listener? Reminder here that you're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Goodness KX935. My topic tonight, how not to raise a brat. And I'm offering up some opinions on that from Dr. Jim Fogarty, a psychologist who has made that one of his priorities. He says, if you overindulge your children, you're perpetuating the message that if you give me what I want, I'll love you, and if you don't, I won't. He says, obviously, the word no comes into the equation. Learn to say no, but if your no is going to quickly become a yes, your children realize they know how to manipulate you. Don't negotiate with young children 7 years old or younger. He says, if you do, you'll create little attorneys that are going to argue. That's what attorneys do. They're going to argue for the best deal for their client. Young children don't understand meeting in the middle. They don't have the ability, apparently, when they're under the age of 7, to meet in the middle. They just want what they want. So, even though you can negotiate with older children, you're not supposed to with children under 7. And if you do, when those children become teenagers, they'll always be focused on the best deal for their client, which is them. And instead of meeting in the middle, they'll just continue nagging. So he says, listen for the guilt trips. Get indignant, then just say no.
And if she tempts you with a charm, tell her no, 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 no.
Mana, no way, no way. Mana, mana, not today.
My name is no, my sign is no, my number is no. You need to let it go, you need to let it go, need to let it go.
Not to the eye, to the no, no, no.
My name is no.
No, no, no. You're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic on tonight's show is how not to raise a brat. I'm bringing you some words of wisdom from Dr. James Fogarty, who's a child psychologist, to adopt or ignore as you will. Dr. Fogarty says, let the sting of discipline happen, because the sting has a lesson. Yes, there's emotional pain with discipline. Your children are going to feel guilty, but if they feel guilty, they're going to be predisposed to make amends, and making amends can resolve that guilt. And when you grow up, if you make amends with somebody that you've offended, you have the opportunity to salvage the relationship and assuage the guilt that you probably felt. If you're not disciplined, you don't learn the lesson of making amends. So let your children feel the sting of discipline and the accompanying sting of guilt, because otherwise they won't learn to make amends, and making amends is a necessary lesson to learn for later in life. Making amends involves apologizing, but also compensating others for the damage they've done. So if they've broken a friend's toy, maybe they should give the friend one of their toys as compensation. And if a teenager does it, they should pay for it. Making amends teaches children the full impact of their actions, says Dr. Fogarty. And if a child sees their favorite toy is gone as compensation for their destruction of another child's toy, they get a real sense of the loss that they've created for others. Now, children don't always understand painful emotions, not just guilt, but things like grief and sadness and helplessness. So you're the one that has to give them the straight story. It's useful to have a children's dictionary around to explain these emotions in terms of pure definition. In a children's dictionary, helplessness is defined along the lines of you had something difficult happen and you try and try and try to change it, but you just can't make it happen. For a child, that is a definition of helplessness. Once your children understand the definition, you can attach good thinking to it by telling your children it's normal and natural to have such feelings, so that they don't think, what's wrong with me for having those feelings? Maybe I'm not normal. And Fogarty says, try not to live above your financial means, because the more time you have to spend worrying about paying for your stuff and your toys and your status symbols, keeping up with the Joneses, the less time you have for your children, certainly the less relaxed time. And where you decide to spend your time reflects what you really value. So if it's your stuff over your kids, they'll pick up on that. And if it's your kids over your stuff, they'll pick up on that. Besides, smaller homes force families to have more personal interactions. Larger homes with large bedrooms create cocoons for children to isolate themselves. One other thing, he says, don't keep secrets. There's something about truth that loves to rise to the surface, and children have ears like sponges. They absorb everything, every little bit in a telephone conversation, every little glance when certain topics come up for discussion.
Why do you smile like you've been told a secret? Now you're telling lies 'cause you just want to keep it, but no one keeps a secret. No one keeps a secret. Why, when we do our darkest deeds, do we tell? They burn in our brains, become a living hell. 'Cause everybody tells, everybody tells. Got a secret, can you keep it? Swear this one you say, better lock it in your pocket. Taking this one to the grave. If I show you, then I know you won't tell what I said. 'Cause two can keep a secret if one of them is dead. Look into my eyes, now you're getting sleepy. Are you hypnotized by secrets that you're keeping? What you're keeping, I know what you're keeping. Got a secret, can you keep it? Swear this one you'll save. Better lock it in your pocket, taking this one to the grave. If I show you, then I know you won't tell what I said. 'Cause two can keep a secret if one of them is dead.
Allison?
Yes, Catherine?
I have something I want to tell you, but you have to promise never to tell anyone.
I promise.
Do you swear on your life?
I swear on my life.
Swore you never tell. You swore.
Show you, then I know you won't tell what I said. 'Cause two can keep a secret if one
of them is dead. Got a secret, can you keep it? Swear this one you'll save. Better lock it in your pocket, taking this one to the grave. If I show you, then I know you won't tell what I said. Cause two can keep a secret if one of them is dead. Got a secret, can you keep it? Swear this one you'll save. Better lock it in your pocket, taking this one to the grave. If I show you, then I know you won't tell. Two can keep a secret if one of them is dead. Yes, two can keep a secret if one of them is dead. Yes, two can keep a secret if one of us is dead.
If you keep secrets from your children, you'll learn that they're keeping secrets from you, even if it's just the secret that they happen to know your secret or know you have a secret. Says Dr. Fogarty. Think about the people you know who have kept secrets from you. You probably don't trust them, right? Well, same with your children. So your secrets create distrust. Plus, it's best if your children hear secrets from you. If you leave it to others, they may not handle that secret very well. So, them's the secrets of not raising a brat. My topic on tonight's Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James. On Laguna's KX935. One friend of mine, who's raising a daughter single-handedly, said that her mother gave her some very good advice. She said she also gave her some advice that didn't work, but this particular piece of advice did. Her mother had said to her, you know, it's just the two of you. Talk to her constantly, even as a baby, even things that she wouldn't understand. Tell her how your day went. Talk about this new congressman you just voted for that you like and what he stands for. The new restaurant you went to with your friend and what you ate and the people at the next table and what happened. She said it sets up the line of communication between the two of you so that you'll always talk to each other. And there'll come a point, obviously, when she will completely understand everything that you're telling her and hopefully vice versa. So this, my friend, is a mother of a girl. Girls are, of course, much more verbal than boys, so I can't promise that that same tack would work with boys, but certainly couldn't hurt, and maybe it'll make the boy more verbal. Who knows?
Talk to me. Talk to me.
Yeah.
That was a little bit of homegrown advice for you there on my topic tonight of how not to raise a brat on this The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. This one mother's daughter who was having dinner with us last night suggested of her own volition that tracking was important for a parent to track a child to know their whereabouts. But if you think about it, as some recent philosopher just said, think of the past few hundred years as a day, 24 hours. All these devices we have now, and a whole way of life now, really has only evolved in the past 5 minutes. I mean, we didn't have any such tracking devices when I grew up, for sure. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have cell phones. You were either home by the phone or you weren't in contact with anybody. We barely had cars. We had public transportation and walking. And that's just in my lifetime. In my parents' lifetime, no aeroplanes. In their parents' lifetime, basically the village you grew up in was the village that you stayed in. And community units were very strong. If you're a community brat, would be hard for anyone to tolerate you. Well, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of this My Sharon Hour tonight. If you want to hear this show again, go to our dedicated website, kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, a pun on my name, hour with the H. You can also listen to this podcast on iTunes. I'm Sharon James. My topic with Hubris tonight was how not to raise a brat or how to not raise a brat. And we were talking about terminal brats, not the occasional bit of brattiness. A little bit of naughtiness is to be expected and even welcomed from a child to show that they have their own sense of what's what. So I'm going to leave you with this from the musical Matilda. I'm going to say goodbye here. From Sharon James of KX935 Sharon Hour. Have a great week, and I hope you'll come back every Sunday at 6 to listen to more topics and conversation.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. So they say the subsequent fall was inevitable. They never stood a chance, they were written that way. Innocent victims of their story. Like Romeo and Juliet, 'twas written in the stars before they even met. That love and fate and a touch of stupidity would rob them of the hope of living happily. The endings are often a little bit gory. I wonder why they didn't just change their story. We're told we have to do what we're told, but surely sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, nothing will change. Even if you're little, you can do a lot. You mustn't let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top you, might as well be saying you think that it's okay, and that's not right. Cinderella in the cellar didn't have to do much as far as I could tell. Her godmother was two-thirds fairy. Suddenly her lot was a lot less scary. But what if you haven't got a fairy to fix it? Sometimes you have to make a little bit of mischief. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grow. of a boat, there's a tiny revolt. The seed of a war in the creak of a floorboard. A storm can begin with a flap of a wing. The tiniest mind.